I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Well, who would have thought that both Kansas and Missouri congressional races would be in the limelight this year? Today, political reporters following the state and local races give us the latest on the battles for the U.S. Senate and House, and those for Missouri Governor and Attorney General. Then we'll move to the national stage with E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post. We'll ask him where the House and Senate are headed and if Clinton can overcome the latest email revelation. We'll complete the political trifecta with this week's edition of State House Blend. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. You may have heard there's an election a week from today. A big one, in fact. Well, today we're going to focus on the races taking place here at home in Missouri and Kansas, and we'll touch on the presidential race, at least as it's playing out in these parts. One question, why isn't the Trump-Clinton race more competitive in Missouri when it's thought to be intensely competitive in another Midwestern state just up to the north of us, and that's the state of Iowa? Joining us today are KCUR's Amy Jeffries. She's the Kansas Elections Editor. Amy, good morning.
Good morning.
KCUR contributor Brian Ellison is here. He hosts State House Blend Missouri. Brian, good morning.
Hey, Steve.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, reporter Jason Rosenbaum. Jason, nice to have you.
Nice to be back.
Well, Jason, the top two races in Missouri were thought to have been settled weeks ago. Republican Senator Roy Blunt had a big lead, and so did Democrat Chris Koster, the candidate for governor. Now the polls suggest both races are toss-ups. What's going on?
Well, I didn't think either race was really decided weeks ago, to be honest. Eric Greitens has an incredible amount of money being sent to him, both from the Republican Governors Association and from larger donors he's cultivated over the years. So when somebody is able to spend upwards of $20 million or so for a race, they're going to keep it close no matter how politically astute their opponent is. And with the Senate race, I think we're seeing kind of a reverting to form for Missouri Senate races. It wasn't too long ago in 2002 and 2006 that Missouri Senate races were very competitive, very close, had buy-in from national parties. And the last two Senate races have kind of been outliers in some respects. They've been not very close. And I think that's kind of thrown off the perception of how close Missouri Senate races can be. I expect both of those races to be within a couple percentage points, given the intensity of both campaigns and
right.
just the fact that that we have four solid candidates running in totality.
Brian, what's your sense of all this, why these top two races are so darn close?
Well, I think Jason is clearly right. The significant amount of outside money coming into the gubernatorial on the Greitens side was going to keep that race close all along. I will also say, though, that I think the success of Donald Trump, and I know we'll probably talk more about that as well, is pretty key to the success of Eric Greitens. They both represent this outsider point of view. They both represent this I've never held elective office mentality. Even the sort of tone of their campaign, their blow up the Capitol sort of attitude is fairly similar. And as Donald Trump has maintained a solid lead in Missouri, even as races have tightened in some other states, as you mentioned, it's not surprising to me that Eric Greitens is succeeding. As for the Kander Blunt race, I think in an odd sort of way, the same dynamic is at work. Every TV ad you see these days seems like it's tying Jason Kander to Hillary Clinton. If Hillary Clinton is going to lose Missouri by 5 to 8 points, then that's going to be a real uphill battle for Jason Kander.
You know, what's interesting, you hear this chatter among politicos a lot these days, Jason, this notion that if Trump can win Missouri by, let's say, 10 points or more, that will pull the other Republicans along with him. You get below 10, the races seem to tighten up, and then they're in coin flip territory. Are you hearing that a lot too, Jason?
I am, and I mean, that should have happened in 2012 because Mitt Romney almost won the state by 10 points. The variable, though, was Todd Akin had a disastrous Senate campaign that
right.
destroyed a bunch of other campaigns. Now, say what you will about Roy Blunt or Eric Greitens. I know that Democrats don't like them for any particular reason. But I don't think either one has made an Aiken-like catastrophic mistake. So it's really going to showcase if Trump really does win the state by 10 points, which I don't think is a sure thing. It may be closer. I haven't seen any evidence that Hillary Clinton is going to win Missouri. But if that scenario unfolds, it will. I think that is the conventional wisdom that it's going to help a lot of Republicans. But I think the real test of that will actually be in the results, because Chris Coster has cultivated a lot of conservative and arguably Republican support over the years. And Jason Kander is, I don't know if he's trying to get Republican support behind him, but he certainly is getting enough support for national parties to pour in millions of dollars on his behalf.
You know, there's a really interesting dynamic going back to the race for governor for a moment, Brian. Chris Coster, the Democrat we're talking about here, is emphasizing his experience. He says often that the governor's office is not a place for on-the-job training. And yet, this is supposed to be the year of the outsider, as you two are pointing out. Is he making a giant mistake here?
Well, I guess time will tell. It certainly seems like that argument worked for a while. I mean, there was no question that the outsider was a compelling argument. It got him to a certain point. In these last days of the campaign, I don't know that either candidate particularly benefits from being seen as an outsider, or even from their experience. At this point, that's the sort of thing that you campaign on when you don't know very much about the candidate's positions. Mm-hmm. At this point, I think both of them are out there in the press enough that certainly Coster is not going to be able to win on his experience alone, and Greitens is not going to be able to win on his outsider status alone. It seems to me more likely that it's going to come down, as I guess it always does, to voter turnout.
Yeah.
Who are they going to pull out there? I mean, if you look at Eric Greitens' campaign schedule just today, as an example, he has a series of 5 town halls in around southeast Missouri. He is hitting, in these closing days of the campaign, the campaign hotspots of Ledington, Ironton, Piedmont, Poplar Bluff, and West Plains, Missouri. You know, he's going to VFW halls with 100, 150 people. That, to me, suggests that this is going to come down to the wire of who you get out. He's in his strongholds. You're going to see Chris Coster hitting St. Louis and Kansas City, perhaps more than he has in the campaign up to this point.
But Jason, I think you can make the case that at least up to now, this has been the year of the outsider in Missouri. Donald Trump, Eric Greitens, Josh Hawley for Attorney General, arguably Jason Kander viewed as the outsider in that race for the U.S. Senate. What's our love affair with outsiders? What's that all about?
And don't forget
Jay Ashcroft,
Secretary
there you
of
go.
State,
yeah,
although
great.
Although his dad was definitely an insider.
Of course.
I think it's been kind of mixed of those examples. But then in like lieutenant governor's race, you have 2 elected officials. And in the attorney general's race on the Democratic side, you have Teresa Hensley, who's a longtime official. I think it just really depends on the candidate. Even Jason Kander, who I think is an outsider to federal politics, not really an outsider to Missouri state politics. He served 2 terms in the Missouri House. He got elected to statewide office. And you aren't able to really achieve either of those things without, you know, maneuvering around the political environment a little bit. So I think it's kind of been a race by race situation. But if Greitens, for example, wins, I think this will be the first time in many decades that we've had a governor here in Missouri without any prior elected experience. You'd have to go back to the 1930s or 40s to find a person.
Let me just tell you about Eric Greitens, just listening to him and talking to him on Sunday evening here in town. He's the most relentlessly on-message candidate I think I've ever covered. I mean, every other sentence began with corrupt career politician referring to his opponent. Boy, he is on it. He's a Navy SEAL. He's disciplined. He knows how to stay with a message.
Well, right. And then that message being corrupt career politician and also the railing against Jefferson City as it currently exists, which of course is dominated in the General Assembly by Republicans, is going, if he is elected, to make his leadership pretty difficult from the start by most observations. He's ostracized a lot of the Republicans who he would then have to work with as colleagues.
Yeah. Well, let's flip over to Kansas for a minute and this big race for Congress in the 3rd District. These two are going at it on TV. Democrat Jay Seide tying Republican Kevin Yoder to Governor Sam Brownback. Yoder is saying Seide doesn't vote in elections very often. Yoder's an incumbent, and incumbents supposedly rarely lose. What's that all about, Amy? What's your sense of what's happening there?
My sense is that Jay Sidey, who is the Democratic candidate running against Yoder now, has been trying to tie Kevin Yoder to the governor all along.
Yeah.
He's been hammering on that since actually even before the primary in August, when it wasn't even confirmed yet that, that Sidey would be the candidate running up against Yoder. So, you know, it is kind of funny on both sides. You know, Yoder never served with Brownback. By the time Brownback had been elected governor, Yoder was on his way to Congress. You know, but nonetheless, you've got Sidey out there saying, "Hey, Yoder is the architect of of Brownback's school funding plan," which, you know, that's an issue that, that resonates big time, especially in Johnson County and also in Wyandotte, which is another big chunk of the 3rd congressional district.
Well, it's an interesting race, Amy. You've spent some time looking at who's paying for this big judicial retention campaign. That's all about the state Supreme Court and other judges in the state. That's very much underway right now. First, remind us what this issue is all about.
Sure. There are 5 Kansas Supreme Court justices who are up for retention this year. Voters get an up or down vote on whether they should stay on the bench. And it would be really quite unusual for a justice to be ousted. But there
hardly
are folks,
ever happens.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that it has happened in modern history. But some folks are really upset about these justices and some of their rulings on things like school funding and against abortion restrictions and death sentences. Now, I will say that the latest poll from the Docking Institute suggests that the Supreme Court of Kansas has a better approval rating than both the governor and the legislature. So,
which may not be saying much these days.
So when we're talking about folks being upset with the Supreme Court, we're talking about a particular subset. And there's some evidence that's what's going on here is an effort to preserve Governor Brownback's policies and his legacy.
Well, just yesterday, just for the record, I got a flyer in my mailbox at home from Kansans for Justice, mm-hmm. a group titled that, based in Wichita. This was a flyer that had this headline, Amy: "Rapists, murderers, cop killers, their death sentences all overturned in all capital letters by the Kansas Supreme Court." Do you have any idea who Kansans for Justice is?
Well, the face of the group are family members of victims of the Carr brothers. They were two guys who went on a rampage murdering 5 people in Wichita in that area in 2000. And the Supreme Court, the Kansas Supreme Court, threw out death sentences against them on a technicality, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then the U.S. Supreme Court overturned that. But the Carrs have never been out of prison. Let's just make that clear. There's never been an effort to let these guys go. But that's what all the fuss is about. There is an effort to try to use concern over the death penalty and murderers running around Kansas to try to get these justices off the bench.
Any other sense of who's paying for the judicial retention election right now?
Yeah, we're trying to figure out exactly who all is behind the funding for the Kansans for Justice group directly. But we've also seen lots of flyers coming out that look like this one. This one's kind of a clever thing that I picked up at the Kansas State Fair, which has little tear sheets for voter guides of who to not retain or retain on the bench in Kansas. And this was put out by Kansans for Life, which is a large anti-abortion group in Kansas. And they have gotten tens of thousands of dollars from Roadmap PAC, which is Governor Brownback's political action committee.
That's interesting. Just one final point, Amy. Do you have any read on the likelihood of the Kansas legislature now moving more to the middle? Is that based on the primary results? Is that where we're headed here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the primary results, what you had there was you had 8 incumbent members of the House and 6 members of the Senate in Kansas who were bounced from their seats by more moderate challengers. And now you have what right after the primary looked like at least 10 more Senate races and 20 more House races that were competitive in the general elections. And that was based on both a voting history there and how well Brownback did. in his last election, but also fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just glancing at the fundraising reports that were due yesterday from all the campaigns. But it looks like that number of races is pretty much still competitive. So it is in all likelihood that some of those Democrats will win, and so you'll have
a turning of the page.
Yeah,
in Kansas
and
a
most
bit.
Most of those competitive races now, with the exception of one or two, really are competitive between a Democrat and a conservative incumbent or a conservative candidate.
Okay, let's go back to Missouri here in a different race. The contest for Attorney General pits two very different people with different priorities. Brian, you just did a story on all this, as Kyle Palmer alluded to earlier. Give us a sense of this one.
Sure. This race has the Democrat, Teresa Hensley, who is a former Cass County prosecutor, facing off against the Republican, Josh Hawley. Hawley is 36. He's a law professor at Mizzou. He has never held elective office, so he has sort of the outsider thing. But at the same time, he has the experience he cites is his work on federal appeals cases, a couple of Supreme Court cases, including the Hobby Lobby case that protected corporations' rights to declare a religious objection and do things like not provide birth control coverage for their employees. Teresa Hensley cites her experience as a prosecutor and the hundreds of cases she's prosecuted and the people she's put behind bars and the victims she has worked with. What emerges are two very different personalities, but also two very different views of what the job even is.
Yeah.
Is the attorney general supposed to represent the state advocating for causes at federal courts, or is the attorney general supposed to be sort of the chief law enforcement officer of the state and tend to the state's own judicial processes?
Yeah. Jason Rosenbaum, the race for lieutenant governor in Missouri is between Democrat Russ Carnahan and Republican Mike Parson. Is the Carnahan name going to be enough to get him across the finish line there?
It very well might. This is actually one of the more competitive statewide races that I've seen. We talked with both candidates last week. They're both two very strong, policy-oriented candidates who have the financial wherewithal to get their message out. And I think that Carnahan, in particular, because the fact that he is the son of former Governor Mel Carnahan, his sister was also in statewide office, Robin Carnahan, Secretary of State, that gives him a built-in advantage, just as Jay Ashcroft may have an advantage over Robin Smith for a similar reason. I don't want to make any predictions, but given the fact that both of them have spent a relatively similar amount of money on TV ads and the fact that they both have pretty strong geographic bases, I wouldn't be surprised if this one is decided by 1 or 2%.
That's interesting. And just finally today, this notion of the presidential race in Missouri. In Iowa, it's very close, Trump having a slight edge here. Why is Trump leading by so much in a state like Missouri, Brian? What's your sense of that?
It's a great question. Certainly the dynamics of Iowa have always, or at least in recent years, have gone a little more Democratic than in Missouri, but I have to say that I think the key element of Trump's support base is white non-college educated voters who have a pretty significant portion of the population of Missouri, especially outside of St. Louis and Kansas City. These are the areas where you're seeing the statewide candidates stumping, and I think that's going to be the secret to Donald Trump's success here as well.
Okay, Brian Ellison, KCUR contributor from St. Louis Public Radio, reporter Jason Rosenbaum, and KCUR's Amy Jeffries, the Kansas Elections Editor. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
Time for a break. Thanks. When we come back, E.J. Dion will join us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we heard about a podcast that breaks down the movie Alien 1 minute at a time. And we also spoke with poet Billy Collins about his writing process. You can hear those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, get both sides of Missouri's Amendment 2 ballot measure, which could change how political campaigns are funded in this state. We'll also hear about something you might be going through right about now. It's called election stress disorder. You can put me in that camp. Well, E.J. Dion is well known on this radio station for his weekly Friday afternoon political commentaries on All Things Considered with David Brooks. E.J. has a new book out, which is now available in paperback. Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to Trump and Beyond. E.J. Dionne is a best-selling author, a syndicated columnist who appears twice weekly in the Washington Post and nearly 100 other newspapers. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor at Georgetown University. He's here fresh off an airplane, and E.J., so good to have you
here.
It's
so great to be on with a journalist, professor, NPR guy.
I was going
to
say,
when you said that thing about the alien, I thought, is that your intro to our discussion of this campaign? But fortunately, it isn't.
We can go there if you want. That's where we are.
Stay away.
Well, let's go to your book just for a few minutes, because you say you have to go back to the Barry Goldwater election of 1964 to figure out where the right went wrong. EJ, that election has ramifications, you say, that linger to this day?
Right. The core argument of the book, the first sentence of the book, is the history of contemporary American conservatism is a story of disappointment and betrayal. And I argue that ever since Goldwater, Republican politicians have had to make a series of promises that they couldn't keep about reducing the size of government. Well, Nixon didn't do it. Neither Bush did it. Reagan didn't do it. A promise effectively to turn back the cultural change of the 1960s, the country of the changes of that era. And then of late, there's a kind of implicit promise, and you hear it explicitly from Trump with his deportation talk, of sort of restoring the ethnic makeup of the country back to where it was 30 or 40 years ago. They can't keep those promises. Yeah. As a result, they've created a lot of alienation from the base. And I argue that it's Goldwater, whom we remember warmly and rightly so, because he was a warm human being. He became somewhat more moderate later in life. But the 64 Goldwater was a pretty radical conservative. We'll just go back and read The Conscience of a Conservative, the book he put out back then. And he put them on this path. The other thing that I argue in the book that the Republicans have a problem with, and Trump really represents his triumph, and the party represents this, is they've relied on a white working class, lower middle class base for a long time. And that base has really had no real material benefit out of the Republican program. And they have gotten very impatient. And that's not just a liberal like me saying this. Ross Douthat, the columnist for New York Times, Raihan Salam, a very smart conservative intellectual, wrote a book 8 years ago saying, you know, if the party doesn't deliver for these working class voters, there's going to be an explosion. And that explosion is Donald Trump.
Well, what happened back in 1964? Because this was the era of John F. Kennedy. This was the era of Lyndon Johnson. Why did the Republicans go so far to the right with someone named Barry Goldwater?
Well, the conservatives in the party had always felt that the party had gone against them when Robert Taft lost all those nomination fights way back when. I'm taking us even back farther to people like Tom Dewey and Wendell Willkie.
Yeah.
And they had been, and they didn't like Dwight Eisenhower. They thought Eisenhower was too moderate. Indeed, you know, the John Birch Society said he was a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy, or an unconscious agent. I can't remember which. Bill Buckley, who didn't like Eisenhower, said, oh, come on, he's just a golfer. And in fact, in my book, by the way, Ike is a hero, because I argue that was the alternative form of conservatism, a moderate form of conservatism that I think in an updated form we could use right now. So they felt that their ideas hadn't been tried, that moderates and liberals were in control of the party. And, you know, here in Missouri, there were a lot of serious moderate Republicans back in those days, and they existed all over the country, and they were slowly driven out of the party. Some of them left voluntarily. Some of them lost primaries. And then over time, the moderate Republicans in more Democratic districts lost elections because Democrats were willing to vote for moderate Republicans, but they felt they were supporting an increasingly conservative
party. Well, the whole state of Kansas is built on moderate Republicans.
Exactly. I mean, the Brownback story, which I talk about in the book, is a really good example. You know, Dole is pretty conservative, but he was a moderate conservative. Nancy Landon Kassebaum was a very moderate Republican. And in that legislature over the years, there were always Republicans who cared a lot about the public schools. They were not radical conservatives by any means. And you've seen a kind of realignment in Kansas politics because of that.
And Nancy Kassebaum has famously said she couldn't get reelected today.
Right. She would lose a primary.
Bob Dole says she's the most popular politician he's ever worked with, you know. Going back to 64, though, I'm wondering how big of a debacle really was it, EJ, because you fast forward to 1968, the Republicans win. Richard Nixon wins the first of two presidential terms. The party couldn't have been hurt too badly by Barry Goldwater in 64.
Well, it really helps when the other side implodes, and that's what happens to the Democratic Party. They split. Lyndon Johnson decided to escalate in Vietnam. That created an enormous opposition in the primaries that year. Both Gene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy. Gene McCarthy first contesting Johnson. He drops out. Humphrey gets the nomination. It's worth remembering that Nixon only got, I think it was 43% of the vote. George Wallace took a big chunk out of the Democratic vote in the South. So you really had the Democrats splitting in two ways. The right end, the segregationist end, went one way. And some lefty Democrats just didn't want to reelect the Democrats after Johnson.
Yeah.
And so now by 1972, Nixon really did begin to build a new conservative majority. And, Reagan is credited with that in 1980. But a lot of the building blocks of mm-hmm. that conservative coalition were put there by Richard Nixon. But I think a lot of that came from the failure of the Democrats. And, of course, in Reagan's case, the country was in a heap of economic trouble in 1980, which helped defeat Jimmy Carter.
So your point ultimately then, E.J., is that the Republican Party can't get out of the conservative straitjacket that Barry Goldwater put the party in back in 64.
Right, partly because the base of the party has changed. We talk about the decline of moderate Republican office holders like Nancy Kassebaum, but also in the Republican primary electorate, the people who used to be moderate Republicans either became independents or, in many cases, Democrats. A good example of this, suburban collar counties around Philadelphia. If Hillary Clinton holds her lead against Trump in Pennsylvania, the place that Trump will lose that election is in these suburban counties that were very loyally Republican, as long as the Republicans were people like George H.W. Bush or John Hines. But they are not going to support this party. And in the Republican primaries this year, between them, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz got roughly 70% of the vote. That tells you where that primary electorate is. That's not sort of imposed from above. That comes from below. And so it's very hard, I think, for the party to move away from this, again, assuming Trump loses this election, which we can get to later. It's a real challenge for the party to move away because they're missing a moderate piece that somebody who would want to rebuild a more moderate form of conservatism would need.
But every time a more moderate alternative emerges, that person gets crushed.
Right.
Well, it's not working.
Looking at this array of Republicans this year, John Kasich, governor of Ohio, was the most moderate, and he's a pretty conservative guy. He was part of the Gingrich Revolution, but comparatively speaking, he was the moderate candidate this year. And, he won a primary in his home state of Ohio. He got a lot of good press clippings, but he ran third in the end.
Yeah.
And then Jeb Bush, representing some kind of moderate conservatism, also got crushed in this campaign.
E.J. Dionne is my guest. His new book, now out in paperback, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to Trump and Beyond. Well, let's talk about this election, because have you ever seen anything like it before in your career?
Not only have I never seen anything like this, but I love politics. I love campaigns.
I get that impression.
I am always unhappy when campaigns end. And this year, this is the first campaign in my life where I cannot wait for this thing to end.
Everybody, EJ.
It is one of the ugliest races. And it's one of the things I'm worried about for the long run.
Of course.
I had a wonderful experience as a columnist you almost never have recently. I gave a talk in St. Louis. It's a good year for me. I'm in Kansas City and St. Louis in the same year. And I used a line. I said, if I had a hat, it would say, "Make America Empathetic Again." And somebody in the audience actually printed the hat, and I got it in the mail yesterday.
No kidding.
Made one for him and one for me. And I really worry that it's not just that we hate each other's candidates, but we're really starting to hate each other.
Absolutely.
As Americans. We don't understand each other. I worked on a poll with Brookings, where I work, with a group called PRRI, a not-for-profit polling group, where the number of Americans who don't somebody who's voting for the other candidate is staggeringly high. And so we not only dislike the opposition, but we don't get along in a very deep sense. And if Clinton wins this race, which, despite the Comey thing, I think she still will, one of the first things I hope she does before she's inaugurated is a speaking tour
to the parts of the country that voted for Trump, particularly Appalachia, some of the old mill towns in the Northeast and Middle West, where people are really hurting. And, you know, there are complicated reasons why people are voting for Trump. There is some racism in that campaign. You're seeing it at rallies. There's this alt-right that I find very scary, some anti-Semitism. But there are a lot of voters who were just got hammered by the economy for the last 30 years. Well, those are the people she needs to talk to and say, look, you didn't vote for me. You may never vote for me again, but you've got legitimate grievances, and I'm going to try to deal with them because we got to stitch ourselves back together.
I was going to say, the winner has to do something here to pull this country together, because whoever emerges, it's going to be, it's a mess.
It is a mess.
And something that it speaks to our higher selves needs to occur here, doesn't it? I mean, it's a gimme, it seems to me.
Yeah, and I think there will be, there will be that need. And, you know, if you read my column, you know, I have very little use for Donald Trump, just to be right out there. I don't see how he could do it other than maybe guarantee everybody $1,000 in his casino, his casinos or something. I don't see it in him to be a unifier. Maybe he'd surprise us. You know, I do think Clinton does have it in her. She gave actually a very interesting speech early on in West Virginia that got very little attention, where she said explicitly, you're not going to vote for me, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to serve you. And I think that's a kind of message that has to get out there. But I also think we need sort of more understanding of each other. Empathy shouldn't be a matter of which groups are fashionable to be empathetic toward, that we should be empathetic to African-Americans in the inner city who worry about their kids getting shot when they're unarmed. We should also be empathetic to the white guy in a factory town or in rural America who has seen his, and I say guys because they are among the most angry, who've seen their standards of living collapse. There's no reason why you can't feel and try to feel those problems, see those problems, and try to do something about them together.
Has there been any upside to this campaign that you've been able to discern here? Is there anything that's happened that bodes well for us going forward? Because I haven't found it. Maybe you have.
A couple of things. One is, I think really bringing home the hurt in parts of America, the economic hurt, that's something. You know, I live outside an affluent suburb outside of Washington, D.C., and that's another thing that divides us deeply is class. And if you live in a rich part of the country right now, you're not seeing all this suffering. I happen to grow up in a mill town, so I have this kind of feeling for places like that. My town still never fully recovered from the Depression, let alone 2008. And so I think Trump and Bernie Sanders both brought these problems to the fore. I think that's good. I think some of the reaction against Trump has also been healthy. It's not the best way maybe to have a discussion of sexual harassment and the like, but we are having that discussion. I think people in their households have had that discussion. That's not useless. And I think that, you know, in some of the backlash against what Trump has said about, say, Muslim Americans, the Khan family, reminding everybody in America, whether you're liberal or conservative, they lost their son because he was fighting for the United States of America. Yeah. And I think it sort of put something in people's heads that's useful to know, that we can't just write off any group of Americans or be bigoted against any group of Americans. So those may be positives out of the campaign. And the first one, you know, is a direct, you know, not so negative product of the Trump campaign. There are a lot of negative consequences, too. And the one I fear most is the legitimation of a certain way of talking about other Americans, Mexicans as rapists, in that famous line. Yeah. This is very bad for us.
Well, before you go, EJ, give us a little insight into your Friday afternoon joint commentaries with David Brooks that are on All Things Considered. They air here each week. They are just terrific 7, 8, 10 minutes of civility and bright insight into what's going on in our world, our politics and everything else. How do those things come together each week? Where do you get the questions? How does it lay out?
Well, first, you were very generous to say that. Oh,
they're
terrific.
It is
one of the favorite things I get to do. So starting Wednesday night or Thursday, we exchange the editors and producers over at NPR and the hosts, and David and I exchange emails about what topics should we talk about, what's most important this week.
And we go around, and generally we agree. The news gives it. Usually the news is fairly obvious, and then sometimes we want to throw in another topic that's not directly on the news to talk about the long run. And then there are Fridays like last Friday where you walk in and a lot of it gets ripped up because of the Comey thing, or another Friday where a lot of it got ripped up because of the Access Hollywood tape. So you roll with what comes in. But that's how we do it. And David and I have known each other a long time. And, you know, David's a moderate conservative.
Yes.
And but, you know, we fundamentally like each other. And I think political arguments are better when people like each other. You can actually have passionate disagreements with people, but if you don't assume they are evil right from the top, you can have a real argument. You push aside the personal stuff and you can get to the issue that you're talking about.
You know, you're talking to a few million people at a moment like that. Do you script out your answers? Do you make notes? How do you handle it?
Sometimes I make notes. I usually have some notes. Sometimes, you know, on a getting some sense of the topic, usually there are things that we've thought a lot about. Some weeks where it's a topic I think I need to study up more, I'll study up more on Friday before we do it. And sometimes it's just spontaneous reaction. A lot of it is spontaneous reaction, especially our one-liners at each other.
And do you go to NPR studios in Washington?
Mostly
to do those
in Washington. Although when we're on the road, we try to keep it going. And my favorite place I ever did it from was the radio booth at the Daytona Speedway.
Really?
Where I announced that I was a NASCAR liberal for a day.
There you go. That's E.J. Dionne. His new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to Trump and Beyond. It's been a pleasure, E.J. Thanks very much.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
You bet. This week's State House Blend Kansas features Republican Russ Jennings representing Garden City, Lakin, and Syracuse way out in west central Kansas.
Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Russ Jennings, state representative of the 122nd District of the Kansas House of Representatives.
And joining Russ and me this morning in the KCUR 89.3 production studio is Stephen Caranda, who covers the State House for KPR and KCUR. Nice to have you back at our podcast table.
Thank you. I had a donut. I'm ready to go.
We are ready to go. Russ, I want to say right off the bat, is unopposed for his reelection to the House seat. So we're going to spend our time today talking not so much about the election, although we will a little bit, but what to expect when the new Kansas legislature convenes in January. But I'm going to start with Stephen and see what's on your mind for Russ Jennings.
So I saw at a community forum a few weeks ago you formally announced or at least said that you would intending to run for speaker. At this stage of the game, what kind of campaigning is going on for a job like that? I haven't seen a lot publicly. Is it behind the scenes kind of stuff?
I've been traveling the state the last couple of weeks meeting with legislators and candidates to become members of the Kansas House, visiting with them a little bit about my vision for how the House might operate in the future, and getting to know those folks. This legislative business is it's a personal relationship business, so I'm attempting to strengthen my personal relationships with those that will be coming in that are new, as well as those that have been serving.
What is that vision you have for the House possibly in the future?
Well, I think the time that I've been there, I've seen the House turn into a place where the voice of members has been squelched through the application of rules in a way that eliminates debate. And one of the most important things to me, and I think in a representative form of government, is that the members have an opportunity to speak to issues, to offer their insights, their experience, their expertise, and use a more collaborative approach to policy decision making in the state.
What we've seen in the past, in recent years, has been that there have been enough conservative-leaning lawmakers that the conservative leadership doesn't necessarily have to take into account some of the point of view of some of the moderates on some issues, and especially not the Democrats on a lot of issues. So they've been able to do things like with tax and budget bills the last couple of years, really get them through with pretty much all conservative votes. And so it's pretty clear that's going to change. And that's one thing I wanted to ask you. No matter what happens this fall, Representative, it looks like there's going to be a lot more moderates and possibly some more Democrats. How do you see that those groups kind of flexing their muscles here in the coming legislative session?
Well, I don't know that any group will flex its muscles. I think regardless of whether I'm speaker or another candidate's speaker, the reality is there's going to have to be a process in place that people have faith in, that they can exchange ideas, and there'll be greater input. And I think that's healthy in the process. Much like it's not really good to have one party have tremendous control over the process either. I mean, politically, and this is where I part ways with some of my friends, certainly politically, you may be an advocate for having 100% Republican or 100% Democrat, but that doesn't bring in the opportunity for a real meaningful exchange of ideas.
Let's move on to some big topics that you're going to have to tackle, whether or not you're a speaker, because you are going to be in the new legislature. What are you going to do about revenue? I've heard a lot of people talk about, and I think closing the LLC loophole, that seems to be palatable to most.
But that won't do enough to fix all our budget problems.
There is the question. So where are you on the LLC loophole and perhaps having to raise taxes to have enough revenue?
Now, it's interesting that there's a correlation between the Supreme Court's finding with respect to school finance, equity, and adequacy. I think the same argument can be made for our tax policy in the state as a whole. Tax policy should be fair, and it needs to be adequate to meet the demand to provide core governmental functions in a way that they can successfully achieve their mission. We lack adequate resources in order for their missions. We will need to make adjustments to our tax code. It's certainly a bit with any specificity what all of that might be, but clearly on the fairness side, I think the people of Kansas have made it clear. I think the politicians in Topeka who are listening have concluded that continuation of business exemption for state income tax is not likely in the cards. That will likely be changed. How that looks in the end, we really don't know until the process occurs. And therein lies the difference between me and, I would argue, others. I'm not about saying this is the way it has to be, and I drive everyone to that ultimate conclusion. This really deserves lots of discussion, lots of debate, lots of input, and an understanding of the implications of whatever decisions are made to come up with the best decision.
How do you see the governor playing ball on this issue, though? These tax cuts have been one of his kind of signature accomplishments, and he has really defended them and wanted to keep them in the last few years.
Well, if you end up with perhaps as many as 45 Democrats and maybe over 40 moderate Republicans, it only takes 84 votes to override the governor's veto. And the governor has repeatedly said recently that the budget is the appropriation process, is the responsibility of the legislature, sounding as if he would like to hand that over to the legislature in its entirety, and a piece of the budget process is the revenue sufficient to go ahead and meet those priorities as articulated through the budget by the legislature.
So am I hearing you're willing to butt heads with him on this issue?
Sure.
Sometime after the election, I think we're going to get a decision on adequacy from the Supreme Court on the Gannon school funding case. How hard is that going to be, in your view, to tackle with everything else that you've got to do in the new legislative session? Is this going to create a big problem?
My thought is, while we have a standing education committee that does all things education, it's probably a year that we need to have a separate committee that does just school finance and budget, and that we have it be a fairly large committee, something similar to appropriations committee size, and give them plenty of time to deeply dig into this, and then to disseminate information as they gain it during the session to all members so that we can all be more up to speed with it. The best way to build consensus in the end is going to be around legitimate information and knowledge. And while it makes it a much messier process than what we've experienced in the past, there'll be more buy-in to the ultimate solution. And I think the ultimate solution will be fairer. So if the court comes in and says, you've got to fund public education at a higher level than you do now, and they give some guidance on what that number is, I think we need to take it seriously. After all, It is the court of last resort for resolving questions with respect to our Kansas Constitution.
Is it fair to say that you were a fan of the previous school funding formula before we went to block grants, that you are leaning more towards that sort of formula where educators would argue, well, you know, the state has an obligation to pay the cost of educating students, and that includes special needs, transportation, whatever that is. So are you more of a fan of, would you be leaning more towards that sort of funding formula?
I think we made a critical mistake in repealing the funding formula. It could have been tweaked in ways to go ahead and provide the stability and the accountability that many articulated a desire to see. And what did we experience? A block grant program. You know, understand what that really was all about. It was constraining and containing ongoing expenses during a period of fiscal challenge in the state. It had nothing to do with really delivering quality education. It was to manage a budget. And now we've gone 2 years with a promise that this next session we would adopt a new process for funding public education, and there's been no conversation about what that would look like through the legislative process. We squandered 2 years of time, deeply dig into this and come up with a really good solution, and now we will be pressed to do it this year. My biggest fear is there will be those that will advocate a continuation of the block grant to get more time to do a formula, and that's why I say, have a special committee. All they do is focus 5 days a week, an hour and a half every day, just on school finance. We need to get this taken care of. That formula was not complex if you knew how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide.
Okay. Gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. Stephen Caranda from KPR, always nice to have you back with us.
Thank you.
So, Russ, this is where we turn the podcast over to you, my friend. You're going to tell us what song is in your head, and that's going to be our walk-off music. What song are you picking?
I would, I would pick the Roy Rogers rendition of Home on the Range.
He's campaigning here with his song choices.
I'm not so sure I can get through the rest of the podcast after that. So, Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. Russ Jennings from Lakin, Kansas. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
I'm Sam Zeff. See you around the radio.
Where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
Catch Statehouse Blend Kansas live tonight at the Johnson County Public Library, the Central Branch, beginning at 6:30. The topic, the future of Kansas public education. Join host Sam Zeff at the library, 9875 West 87th Street, for a live recording of Statehouse Blend Kansas. Tomorrow, learn about the Missouri ballot measure that could change the way political campaigns are funded. Then we'll discuss something many of you may be experiencing right now, election stress disorder. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.